Dolorosa, which means the way of sorrow, it's the name for the route taken by Jesus on his way to the crucifixion. Now, the actual route that this title is applied to has changed over time, as differing theories and archaeology have prompted modifications. Yet while the name focuses on Jesus' suffering that he experienced while he was on this route, we're going to see this morning that at the end of this road, it wasn't simply death on the cross, but on the other side of death was paradise. This morning we're looking at Luke 23, continuing in our study there, starting with verse 26. When they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, coming in from the country, and placed on him the cross to carry behind Jesus. And following him was a large crowd of the people, and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two others also, who were criminals, were being led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And the people stood by, looking on. And even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." Now there was also an inscription above him, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other answered and rebuking him said, "Do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed are suffering justly, for we are receiving that which we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he was saying, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." So starting in verses 26 and 27, when they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, coming in from the country, and placed on him the cross to carry behind Jesus. And following him was a large multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. So, as we've already discussed how Jesus got to this point and Pilate's character flaws that we looked at last week. Right? And so, now as Jesus is being led away to death, right, Luke records that someone else is seized. He's snagged along the way. All right. And the word here simply means to take hold, to grab. All right. And so here, Luke uses this idea of involuntary conscription. This guy happens to be the wrong place, the wrong time, and he gets picked. All right. Now, Luke identifies this man. His name is Simon of Cyrene. All right. Mark also tells us that he is the father of Rufus and Alexander. All right. And that identification is interesting because that means Mark expected his audience to know who Rufus and Alexander were. And so there's a subtle implication we can guess here that perhaps Rufus and Alexander and maybe even Simon became believers possibly because of this event. It's a little bit speculative, but there's basis for it. Now, Cyrene's on the North African coastline, some distance from Jerusalem. And we can't, again, say for certain, but it would seem that Simon is Jewish and may very well be in Israel for the Passover. I mean, that's why Jews have flocked to Jerusalem for this particular day, is for Passover. Right? And when Luke says that he's coming in from the country, it simply means Simon's on his way into town as this procession is on their way out of town. Right? And so whatever his reason was for being there, Simon gets conscripted to carry Jesus' cross. Right? Now, crucifixions, we all know, they commonly happened outside the city. Right? And the Roman policy was to make the condemned carry the means of their execution on their way out. Now, Scripture doesn't say explicitly the reason that there was need for Simon to carry the cross for Jesus. It doesn't say. Now, often, not always, but often it's assumed that Jesus was simply too weak from his beatings and he needed someone else to take over. But Scripture doesn't say it. That's a logical conclusion that's taken. But no Roman would be, pardon me, caught dead carrying a cross. That there's too much shame wrapped up in the idea of carrying this cross. This was a slave's death. This was a criminal's death. You don't get a citizen carrying a cross. So Simon couldn't be Roman citizen. He wouldn't have ended up carrying the cross just by that fact alone. All right. And here we got to pause for a moment and address some of the minor variations between how the Gospels handled this moment. All right. Matthew and Mark both record that they pressed Simon into service to bear Jesus' cross. That's all they say. Now, many people assume that this means the cross was taken off of Jesus, placed onto Simon, and Simon carried it the rest of the way. All right. But Luke's language here implies that's not actually the case. All right. Only Luke notes that Simon carried the cross behind Jesus. We have a location here. He's behind Jesus. John simply says that Jesus carried his cross out to Golgotha. Right. And here, probably what happened, and I'm not saying there's an absolute certainty, but it seems to be that Simon is carrying the cross in addition to Jesus. He is providing assistance, not replacement. So that he's carrying the back half, Jesus carries the front half, so he's got some assistance, but it's not been taken off of Jesus' shoulders. Right? And one commentary notes that the Roman custom was to actually tie the cross onto the criminal. Right, so if it were going to be a replacement, they would actually have to cut the cross off of Jesus to put it on Simon. Right? Whereas with the behind, it still stays tied onto Jesus, and you just lift up the back end and put on another pair of shoulders. So if that's the case, right, that makes Matthew, Mark, and John come together quite well. Right? Who carries the cross? Well, they both do. And following him was a large crowd of people and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. And I'm going to modify that and say, and following him was a large multitude of the people, simply because we've seen in Luke that the word crowd has a particular connotation. This is a different word in the Greek. This is not the word that's used for crowd. This is just a large gathering of people. And the word people here continues to have that mixed connotation that we've seen earlier, right, the people participated in this call for crucifixion and the call to release Barabbas. Right, it wasn't the crowd, it was the people. Right. So we have this people, and here they are following. Right, we've got the people, and then there's a subset of the people. We have women that are mourning and they're lamenting Jesus. Right, and so there's a partial distinction between the ladies and the people, but it's not a strong one. All right? They're part of this crowd that's following behind. All right? And their mourning here shows that at least this group of women don't share in this full scope of opposition to Jesus. These aren't ones that were crying for crucifixion and the release of Barabbas. All right? They are sad. They lament the way things have turned out. All right? And here we do have to know, and it's a little bit of an argument from silence, but in the Gospels, there is never an instance where ladies are shown to be opposed to Jesus' ministry. That's something that the guys do, not the ladies. And here we see the ladies' support and not opposition as well. Verses 28 and 29. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nurse.'" So Jesus talks to this group of ladies that are sad, right, as he and Simon are carrying the cross. And this is his final lesson in his mortal part of his ministry. And these words are not words of comfort. This is not uplifting. This is warning. He calls these women daughters of Jerusalem. And this phrase is taken from Old Testament prophecy, where the phrase is used to indicate the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So here, these ladies that are in sorrow, his warning to them really stands for everyone that's in Jerusalem. He says, stop weeping because of me. All right. So their sorrow about Jesus' impending death, it's genuine. All right. These are not hired lamenters, all right, that are lamenting just because that's their job. Now, these are genuine feelings and genuine emotion that they're experiencing here. All right. So we have this concession. Stop weeping for me, but rather weep for yourselves and for your children. So it's not that their sorrow is inappropriate. Their sorrow is wholly appropriate, but their focus is wrong. All right, and here's, this is kind of an unusual twist. Typically, we're supposed to focus on Jesus. And he says, no, sorrow, don't cry for me. Cry for yourselves. And here he gives us two commands. Stop. Start. Stop crying for me. Start crying for yourselves. All right. And it's for themselves and their children. All right. So this sorrow at his death is appropriate, but not for the reasons that they think it is. All right. This is this warning here. It's a reminder of previous prophecies that Jesus has given regarding the fall of Jerusalem. We saw that back in Luke 19, 41 to 44, and Luke 21, 20 to 24. All right, because of Jerusalem's rejection of Jesus, their Messiah, their King. All right. Jesus' own death ultimately is going to result in victory. All right. Jerusalem's fall isn't. All right. Jerusalem's destruction is going to be a time of sorrow for everyone who lives to experience it, be it man, woman, parent, child. For behold, days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nurse. So here, the four, this is the reason that he says, weep for yourselves. All right. And this is another prophecy. All right. It's just confirming what he has said before. All right. Days are coming. All right. It means future fulfillment. Something's going to happen. His future time is going to be characterized by a mindset that, to those right there with Jesus, would blow their mind. This is completely different to the way the world works. All right. Now, the blessed here, all right, looks to this future time, all right, but it's declared by those people in that time. All right, this is their perspective. You have been blessed by God, all right, if you've never had kids. That's the blessing. In their perspective, that's God's blessing, that you've never had children. Right? And it follows the three stages. You've got conception, pregnancy, nursing. Right? And typically, pregnancy, childbirth was recognized as a blessing, a sign of God's favor on women. Right? And conversely, barrenness was considered a disgrace. Right? If we think back to Luke 1:25, and I realize that it's been a few months. But there we saw Elizabeth rejoicing at her pregnancy with John because her disgrace would be removed before others. She was no longer going to be viewed with contempt because she was pregnant. And now we look forward to this future time, and Jesus says, yeah, that mindset's going to be completely reoriented. During this fall of Jerusalem, the people would rejoice for the ladies that never had children. This is the rejoicing here. This isn't true joy. This is bleak. This is black. Right. The blessing is that the woman, the mother, would never have to witness the violent death of her children. Right. And this grim foretelling, it directly corresponds with the woe declared by Jesus upon the people of Jerusalem that's found in Luke 21:23. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. All right, so new mothers are going to suffer greatly during that fall of Jerusalem. Right? And what should be a time of hope, a time of joy, it's going to be a time of sorrow and despair because of God's punishment on Jerusalem for their rejection of Jesus Christ. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, "Fall on us," and to the hills, "Cover us." For if they do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry? Right, so Jesus continues his warning with this allusion to Hosea 10:8. There it says, "Then they will say to the mountains, 'Cover us,' and to the hills, 'Fall on us.'" And if you'll notice, Jesus quotes it, except for he switches the verbs, right? The hills and the mountains. That's what he's referring to, right? In Hosea's time, Hosea prophesied this against the northern kingdom, right? That the northern kingdom would flee to the hills and to the mountains, and they would beg for swift death by calamity as being preferable to facing the coming Assyrians. "I'd rather be died in a landslide than to face the Assyrians." And so by quoting this, mildly modified, Jesus is comparing the coming destruction of Jerusalem to the time of Hosea and the coming destruction from the Assyrians. It's going to be comparable. And during that time of Jerusalem's fall, the people in the first century would echo the sentiments of those hundreds of years earlier in the northern kingdom. And they would, too, desire the quick death rather than having experienced the full scope of God's punishment in Jerusalem. It says, "For if they do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry?" Right, so here's Jesus' reason for making this dire foretelling. So we have this if then, right, set up. If they do these things when the tree is green, right, and here Jesus uses the metaphor of a green tree, right, and it's the first half of a lesser to greater argument. Right, if they do this to the little, what are they going to do to the big? All right. And this implies the cutting down and the burning of a tree that's still living and productive. Right, and uses that as a metaphor to represent the Roman abuse, the execution of Jesus Christ. Right, he was innocent. He was, even by Roman standards, he was a good person. He had done nothing wrong, nothing deserving of death. Even the Romans declared that. And if this is what the Romans will do to a good man who has done nothing wrong, what are they going to do to all y'all in Jerusalem? So, the second half, the then part, it's in the form of a question: what will happen? What will happen when it's dry? And this metaphor of the dry wood represents Israel's state of rebellion against the Romans in that future time when Jerusalem would fall. All right, if they're willing to crucify an innocent man, what are they going to do with a state that rebels against Rome? Are they going to show mercy? "Well, I didn't do it. I wasn't part of that. That was them and not me." That's not going to carry any weight with the Romans, who are already willing to crucify a single innocent man. Yeah, even if you aren't part of the rebellion, just by being a Jew in Jerusalem, you're going to pay. So Jesus is saying that these women of Jerusalem should weep and lament for the coming destruction of Jerusalem because of God's punishment for Jerusalem's part in crucifying its own Messiah. Because there will be even less mercy for Jerusalem than was shown to Jesus. Verses 32 and 33. "Two others also who were criminals were being led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right, the other on the left." All right, so Luke now introduces a couple more people. All right, these are Jesus' fellow condemned. All right, they are fellows together. All right, but he notes that these two are criminals. All right, and they're on their way to die with Jesus. And this fact here, it's a fulfillment of Jesus' own foretelling in Luke 22:37, that he would be judged with transgressors. All right? And Jesus' prophecy there, right, he says, "For I tell you that this which is written must be fulfilled in me, and he was numbered with transgressors, for that which refers to me has its fulfillment." All right? And even Luke 22:37, it's restating Isaiah 53:12. "Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great and divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors." So this is the fulfillment of Isaiah 53:12. Right here, the fact that he's got these couple of criminals on their way to death with him. "When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left." Right, and we're familiar with the name Golgotha. Right. Luke calls it the Skull, and that's because that's what this hill looked like. If you stood back and looked at it, it looked basic shape and outline. You got eyes and nose. It looks like a skull. What a fitting place to kill people on top of a skull. Right. Now, if you were to go to Israel and take the Golgotha tour, you're going to be taken to a hill that looks something like a skull. May not be this one. There's a little bit of disagreement on whether or not this hill even still exists, or whether it kind of got lost back around 1000 when there was some expansion done. Doesn't really matter. We have the description. We know roughly where he was taken. All right. So here Luke simply summarizes, they crucified him. He doesn't go into great detail. He just says they crucified him and the other two with him. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. So we've seen throughout the book of Luke that prayer is an important theme, important part of Jesus' ministry. And Luke has continued to record Jesus' prayer at critical junctures. Is there any juncture in his ministry more critical than this moment? This is it. This is the end of his earthly ministry, so to speak, or his mortal ministry, at least. And here we have a prayer. It's a petition to God. It's the last prayer recorded by Luke. And this is, actually, there's a theological set. They call it the seven words, right? But it's actually seven different statements, not seven words. Seven statements of Jesus. Right? And here, on the cross, he's already experiencing the agony of this slow death. And Jesus prays on behalf of those who are crucifying him. He says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And the question comes up and it's discussed. Who is he praying for? And some people say, well, he's just praying for the Roman soldiers that are dividing up his stuff. The last little bit of his earthly possessions. I take it to continue on into the next verse, all right, talking about not only the soldiers, but the people and the rulers that are mocking him. All right. This is a prayer for the forgiveness of those who are responsible for putting him up there, whether it's the physical act or the act behind it that got him condemned as an innocent man. He prays for them. Now, Luke records that these soldiers that have crucified him, they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And this alludes to a Roman, I guess not quite a tradition, but a Roman way of doing things, that they crucified their criminals, we'll call it bereft of their outer clothing. Right? It's part of this overall shaming of the criminal. And it's part of the punishment. And since the criminal had no further use for his clothes, the guys that were stuck with the unpleasant duty of having to sit through all this, well, their consolation prize is they got to pick among the condemned's clothing. But the actions of these Roman soldiers is itself a fulfillment of prophecy. And it goes back to Psalm 22:18. "They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." Luke is intentionally going back to Psalm 22, and he's going to do it again in the next couple verses. So this petition for forgiveness, it's a demonstration of Jesus' own external orientation, his humility. Here he is dying, and he is more concerned with the guys that put him up there than he is with himself. He prays for their benefit. Now, I don't know if there would be anybody more authorized, more right to pray an imprecatory prayer right here. Father, strike them down. They deserve it. He could have prayed that, and I think might have been justified, and yet that's not what he says. He doesn't say, strike them down, Father. They're evil and unjust. No, he says, Father, forgive them. Right, he is modeling the very things that he taught in Luke 6:28 and Luke 6:35-37. Luke 6:28 says, bless those who curse you and pray for those who mistreat you. Luke 6:35-37 says, but love your enemies and do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. And do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Pardon, and you will be pardoned. That's what Jesus is doing right here. He is the embodiment of his teaching. He prayed for those who abused him. He expressed his love in the manner beyond the ability of those that are in the process of trying to kill him. They don't even grasp what's going on here. And yet he's showing his love for them. And Jesus' prayer at this point also hits a couple theological principles. First is prayer for the forgiveness of others. And specifically here, in Jesus' part, it's prayer to the Father for forgiveness of the murder of his son. He doesn't say don't hold them accountable for their actions. But rather, God is to demonstrate his mercy and exercise his divine judicial right to forgive those who are guilty. They are guilty of what they are doing. But Jesus asks for mercy despite their guilt. Now, it might be tempting to attribute this prayer as being, well, really only legitimate for Jesus in this unique role as both sacrifice and mediator. I mean, only Jesus can pray this, right? Except Stephen echoes this very prayer in Acts 7:60 as he is in the process of being murdered. This is not something that only Jesus can and should do, but this is a demonstration that we could all benefit from. Now, sin, it's an offense against the Father. But as victims of the effects of those sins, both Jesus and later Stephen acted as advocates on behalf of their murderers. Right? As a side note, that if Jesus did those for those who were responsible for killing him, consider the confidence that we have when we see in John, or 1 John 2:1, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. If he does this for murderers, how is he going to appeal on our behalf? Now, God's response to Jesus' prayer is almost immediate. Right? We see the first manifestations of the Lord's forgiveness. We'll see it next week in Luke 23:47 with the response of the centurion. But the greater impact of this prayer, it's going to be seen in Acts 2:36-38, right? When those who hear Peter's Pentecost sermon, and later in Acts 4:4 with those in the temple, were all convicted of their role in crucifying the Messiah, and they repented. That's the first theological principle in Jesus' prayer. The second one is one we've seen in Luke previously. There are degrees of guilt. We saw that this morning in Sunday school as well with Augustine and Pelagius. But there are degrees of guilt, and ignorance is a mitigating factor. Right? He says, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. Right? Now, this principle goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. Right? Who bears the sin? It's Adam. He did it knowingly. Eve was deceived. So ignorance is a mitigating factor. Right? And this principle of degrees of guilt has also been taught in Luke 12, 47, 48. We saw that in Sunday school. Acts 3, 17 confirms the ignorance of both the people and the rulers. All right? Paul in 1 Corinthians 2, 8 indicates that their ignorance provided the setting for actions that they would not have done knowingly. If they had actually believed and known he was the Messiah, they wouldn't have done this. But they didn't believe. They were deceived. They were blinded. So the ignorance of those who crucified Jesus, it's a mitigating factor, but it doesn't absolve them of their guilt. But Jesus asked for mercy, for forgiveness from the Father for these men that were murdering him. And the people stood by looking on, and even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." Now there was also an inscription above him, "This is the King of the Jews." So here we see the people are standing around. They are observers. They're witnessing the results of their demand for Jesus' crucifixion. These are spectators. Who knew that crucifixion was a spectator sport? That's how this is being treated. Now here we have rulers, and they have achieved the full scope of their deepest desires of what they want with Jesus. They're getting him killed. And they've got him on the cross, and they continue to abuse him. The verb that's used here, it says even the rulers were staring, and the word means to ridicule. All right. They ridicule him as he is up on the cross, and this is how they do it. Say, "He saved others. Let him save himself." And so when they say he saved others, they're in their mind, they're thinking in terms of the miracles that he did on behalf of others. They're not thinking eternal salvation because they don't believe he's Messiah. They're just looking at the miracles Jesus did on behalf of others. All right. And then we have this third person in parable, "Let him save himself." Right? And this is really a command to Jesus. You did it for them, do it for yourself. Right? It uses this logic that if Jesus was able to deliver others, he should and would also apply that power for the purpose of self-preservation. Right? You can see there's a little bit of faulty logic here because they don't understand who he is and what he is doing. Right? But this mocking also implies that if Jesus doesn't save himself, he is incapable of it. He's unable. He doesn't actually have that power. And thus it also questions the legitimacy of his miracles that he has done on behalf of others, which goes back into the accusations they have made as to by whose power do you do these things. They also mock Jesus' identity as the Messiah. They recognize, and rightly, right, that the Messiah, by definition, is God's chosen one. And they use this first-class conditional that we're familiar with, if and it's true. But remember, everything you say, tone is everything. You can say something that is true and you put a little bit of sneer in it, and all of a sudden you infer that you don't actually mean what you're saying. And that's what they're doing here. Well, if this is the Christ of God, and the words say, if and he is, and their attitude says, no, he is not. Right? But if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one, let him save himself. Now this also looks back to Psalm 22, that messianic psalm, verses 7 and 8. "All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip, they wag the head, saying, 'Commit yourself to the Lord, let him deliver him, let him rescue him, because he delights in him.'" So these men don't even for a moment consider the possibility that Jesus is permitting them to sacrifice him. That he is choosing to restrain his divine power to withhold self-preserving actions. That never crosses their mind. And of course, there's tremendous irony in their choice of words here, that he has saved others. All right? And Jesus is in the very act of paying for the sins of all mankind, and in so doing, providing a salvation that is far greater than even the scope of the Old Testament revealed. Their mocking demonstrates that they are only capable of envisioning deliverance that precedes and prevents physical death. That's that when they say deliver and save, they're thinking it's got to happen before he dies or he's not delivered. They have no imagination, or even the fact that we've got Pharisees here, but they've got no imagination of the potential deliverance, the greater deliverance of the resurrection. That much more powerful demonstration of God's choice, God's election of Jesus Christ. Verse 36, the soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine. And Luke uses a synonym, the rulers sneered, the soldiers mocked, same thing. But where the rulers' sneering and ridicule was a continuation of the previous abuse that they were doing back in Luke 22, 63, and 64 regarding Jesus as prophet and now as Messiah, the soldiers continued their mocking of Jesus as king. All right, we saw that when we looked over at John 19, 2 and 3 with the crown of thorns. All right, so each picks a different aspect of Jesus' claim and yet ends up being the same. Luke records that they also offer him a sour wine. And this is part of the mocking. All right? Offer the king his wine. All right? And this reflects Psalm 69, 21. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Verse 37, and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. All right? So they're mocking here. It's in a similar vein. If you were, you would. All right? And since you don't, you aren't. That's what they're saying. They're also using the first class imperative or first class conditional. If and you are, do this. All right. And as with the rulers, they obviously think that Jesus can't. All right, that he is incapable of delivering himself or being saved by God. Now there was also an inscription above him, this is the King of the Jews. All right, now Luke, that's as much as Luke says about it. John 19, 19, and 20 tell us that Pilate chose this specific inscription. He had it written in Hebrew, Latin, Greek, so that any and all who passed by could read it. There would be no ignorance allowed here. All right. And here, after everything that has gone before, Pilate finally found the spine. All right. He refused that the alteration that the chief priest wanted, that he said he was the king of the Jews. No, he said king of the Jews. Now, the presence of a placard like this was common. It usually included both the name of the condemned and the crime for which they were being crucified. So Pilate is saying here, this is why he's being crucified. He's the king of the Jews. Boy, didn't he put his finger on that. Verses 39 to 41. One of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other answered and rebuking him said, do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we, on the one hand, are suffering justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds. On the other hand, this man has done nothing wrong. So it's in this atmosphere of mocking and derision that Luke returns to those two criminals who are there with Jesus. And he records two contrasting pictures now with these two men that are crucified. The first follows the leaders and the Roman soldiers. And here Luke uses an even stronger word than he's used before. He says blaspheming. So this guy takes it to a level beyond what's been said by the others. And he also, he mocks Jesus. He says, are you not the Christ? Again, first class conditional, implying one thing and really saying something else. All right? And the usage here of the if then doesn't come out as well in English. All right? But he says, are you not the Christ? Then save yourself and us. Right? And so here the command and the apostasis, the then part, it also goes beyond. He says, save yourself and us. So in the structure of the taunt, he says that if Jesus doesn't save himself and the criminals, he proves that he's not the Messiah. Now, to me, the amazing part of this man's actions here, the very nature of crucifixion is that the longer you're there, the harder it is to breathe. So sometimes these guys died of suffocation. And this guy is taking his last few hard-earned breaths, the oxygen that takes pain to bring into his body, and he's using that to blaspheme Jesus. And the other answered and rebuked him and said, "Do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation?" So that's, we got the portrait of the first. Now we get the second guy. All right? The other crucified criminal. All right? And Jesus doesn't say anything. Remember, he's the lamb that's silent. Right? But here, this other man now steps up, metaphorically speaking, right? Steps up to the plate, and he defends Jesus. Now, before we talk about his defense, though, we have to consider this man. Because Mark 15:32, Matthew 27:44, both record that both criminals mocked Jesus. But somewhere in Jesus' non-response, one of them gets the picture. One of them finally figures something out and changes on the cross. He goes from mocking Jesus to realizing who Jesus is. Right there. Right. Now, Luke's the only one to record this defense of Jesus. This is a change in perspective. Right. We're never given the motivation. We're never given why. Right. But this criminal, his response has two sides to it. Right. The first is a rebuke of the first side of this response. He rebukes the first criminal. He says, "Don't you even fear God?" And the presence, the question implies that his presence on the cross has already proven that he doesn't fear the Roman government. You did it, you got caught, and here you are. You didn't fear the government. But his insults imply that, yeah, not only doesn't he fear the Roman government, he doesn't fear God. So that thinks back to that judge that we've seen in Luke that feared neither God nor man. Well, apparently this criminal is right there with him. And he points out the logical fallacy of mocking Jesus when he's right there next to Jesus experiencing the same death. And he implies here the first criminal is going to be very, very soon called to account before God to answer for what he is saying to Jesus. He goes on, he says, "And we are suffering justly on the one hand, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds. On the other hand, this man has done nothing wrong." So he provides a contrast between themselves, and he includes himself in that. He says, "We did it. We are suffering justly." This is the application of proper application of justice to crime. We're both here, and he includes himself. We aren't here, there are no guilty men on death row, no guilty men in prison. No, he said, "I'm guilty, and you're guilty, and we both know it." There was no mistake. This shouldn't be thrown out because the DNA is found later. No, we did it. So this is an acknowledgement of guilt, an admission that the punishment is appropriate for what they have done. But then he says, not him, the inverse, not him. On the other hand, this man has done nothing wrong. Right? And he uses the same verb that he says, where we did it, right? We committed it. This man has committed nothing. Jesus hasn't done any crime. He hasn't done anything wrong. And the word that's used here, he's done nothing wrong, that goes beyond the scope of crime. He hasn't done anything inappropriate. Now, this is the sixth time in Luke that Jesus is declared innocent. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. All right. So this petition to Jesus, remember me, it conveys the idea of acting in the future with favor. All right. And this criminal wants Jesus to remember, or wants Jesus to remember him in future time, the coming of the kingdom. All right. He's got an eschatological focus here. All right. He's not thinking in a few minutes, in a few hours, someday, whenever that may be, that you come with your kingdom. All right. And here he acknowledges, just this eschatological focus that he's using here, he acknowledges Jesus is the Messiah, the chosen one of God, the one who is going to rule over that kingdom. The whole Daniel 7, 13, and 14, that's you. That's what he's saying right here. All right. So he says, whenever that is in the future, all right. Notice he says, remember me when you come in your kingdom. He's asking for a restoration to life. Bring me back to life and let me experience that with you. There's no question he's going to die. It's an accomplished fact. He just hasn't quite caught up with it. But he says, in that future kingdom, don't forget me. Don't leave me dead. And he said to him, today I say to you, truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. So this is Jesus' response to this confession of the criminal. He says, today, and he means today. Right? Not someday. Not off in the long-distant future that we know is going to happen, but not any day soon. He says, today. So this stands in contrast with when you come in your kingdom. He says, no, you don't have to wait for that eschatological fulfillment. Right. That new life that you just asked for is going to begin today, same day as their death. Right. And Jesus promises that this man would be with Jesus in paradise. All right, the one that says Jesus heading to paradise. Secondly, you're going to be there with me. Right? And there's this assumption, this understanding, Jesus is a righteous man. He's done nothing wrong. He deserves paradise. He deserves this eternal blessing. Jesus says, you're going to be there with me. You don't deserve it. And this guy's already acknowledged it. I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be executed because of what I did. Don't forget me anyway. Jesus says, you'll be with me. All right? We have God's grace. Right? And we have to pause for a moment and define paradise. All right? Greek words only used three times in the New Testament. We have this verse, and then we have 2 Corinthians 12:4 and Revelation 2:7. All right? In 2 Corinthians, Paul speaks of himself as having been caught up to paradise. If you remember that passage, he says, I don't know if it was bodily or in the vision, right? But he was caught up to paradise. In that same passage, the word paradise is used parallel to the term third heaven. Right? So this demonstrates the use of paradise to refer to a place, a already existing place of unspeakable blessing, glory. Right? Revelation 2:7. The Lord promises that the one who overcomes will eat from the tree of life in paradise. Right? Again, there's this concept of a positive eternal setting, right? But now includes the tree of life. And we're familiar with that language. That goes back to Genesis 2. All right? Genesis 2:9, where there's this tree of life in the Garden of Eden. If we go back to the Old Testament usage of the word paradise, and when I say Old Testament, it's particularly Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. All right? This term paradise is consistently used to talk about either the Garden of Eden or something else that is just like the Garden of Eden. Right? Isaiah 51:3, the word paradise is used to describe that future time of blessing in which the land of Israel will reflect the verdant perfection and life of the Garden of Eden. Right? And here in Luke, this is a reflection of that use that's seen throughout, talking about a future time that's going to be just like the Garden of Eden, just like when there was no sin. So Jesus promises this criminal everlasting life and in blessing using terms he'd recognize, terms he'd understand. Our point this morning, it's one we're all familiar with. Faith in Christ gives eternal life. But as we look at our passage this morning, this declaration by the crucified criminal gives us several aspects that we need to refresh our memory about. First and foremost, we should remember that as long as one is alive and conscious, there's a chance to be saved. This man was terminal. He was already dying. Yet in the last few minutes of his life, he came to faith in Jesus Christ. Now, this is not to encourage unbelievers to wait until the last minute to trust in Jesus, right? But to provide encouragement that it can and does happen. Right? Now, for those of us honest to ourselves, very few people can anticipate the hour of their death. Right? Waiting until one sees death to trust in Jesus is a bad idea in so many different ways. Right? But we can also gain comfort from this dying criminal's confession of faith. Jesus' response to him demonstrates that deathbed conversions, right, those declarations of trust in Jesus that are made when one can see death coming, when they're looking in the face, those can be completely legitimate. Right? We can get trapped between this genuine desire and hope to accept a deathbed conversion at face value, and the same time we're tempted to dismiss it as an act of desperation brought on by the fear of death. And we have in this man a demonstration that conversion at the end of life can be entirely legitimate and result in eternity in heaven. And so discretion's healthy, but we can have confidence in God's grace towards those who may be motivated to faith because they're looking at death in the face. As we look at this confession, we also need to remember not to prejudge who we think will come to faith. This was a violent criminal. Right? He was probably a murderer. That's what crucifixion was for. Right? He admitted he deserved to die for his crimes. This was not a good guy. Right? And yet this man who had done violence still put his trust in Jesus Christ. And God took him through what we know had to be some exceedingly painful experiences, a guaranteed death, to bring him to this point. But the man did believe. And we need to rely on the Lord to work in the lives of others. We present the gospel whenever and wherever we are given the opportunity, even to those we don't like, to those whom we would actually rather be anywhere else but here with you. Yeah, those are the ones we need to give the gospel to as well. Don't look at someone and think, they'd never believe. And let that be our reason for not sharing the gospel. We never know. Right? And as we look at this man's confession, we also recognize what he does and what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, I know you're dying for my sins, thank you for paying for mine. He acknowledges who Jesus is. And he asks for everlasting life. But he doesn't even use the terms everlasting life. All right. The fact is, faith in Christ is simply faith in Christ, right? Regardless of the words used. Right? And some people get caught up in praying a particular prayer, right? Following a specific conversion routine. Right? And anything that falls outside of those categories, they question whether or not salvation's actually happened. This man trusted in Jesus Christ without using any catchphrases. He simply believed, and it was sufficient. And while we discuss the sufficiency of faith, we also have to acknowledge that this criminal stands, and he is the perfect and ultimate demonstration of the sufficiency of faith. All right, this man was hanging on a cross. He wasn't going anywhere. He didn't have the opportunity to be baptized. Matter of fact, he couldn't go anywhere and do good works to confirm that he was saved. Now, baptism is an important affirmation. It's a confirmation of our faith, or a confession of our faith, but it's not necessary for salvation. Nor does this man need good works to prove that he is saved. He can't go anywhere. He's hanging on a cross. But his lack of good works does not keep Jesus from promising he's going to be immediately experiencing paradise. All right, good works cannot be added as a necessary component to salvation. It just doesn't work. And this guy dies to prove it. All right. Finally, yes, I am getting to an end. All right. In the example of this converted criminal, we also see the reminder that those who trust in Jesus experience the immediate blessing of being in heaven, even as we await our own resurrection. Right. We don't wait in some sort of limbo. We don't lay in a senseless, unconscious state for however long it takes for the resurrection to happen. We will be immediately in a place of blessing and glory, even while we retain the greater hope of the resurrection after that. So faith in Jesus Christ, it's the one and only road to paradise. Let's close in prayer. Father, you are a gracious God. You have given us hope upon hope. We thank you for your Son and for the forgiveness you have provided through him. We look forward to the blessing of being united with your Son face to face. Until then, we seek to serve you because we love you. In Jesus' name, amen.